You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.
Hello and welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm Head of Programming, Connor Boyle. Coming up on the podcast, Tim Marshall, the journalist turned author, has reported from all over the world for outlets including the BBC and Sky News, the latter of which he spent over two decades at, in roles including diplomatic editor and Middle East correspondent based in Jerusalem. And that worldly view has fed into Tim's writing. In recent years, his best-selling books based around geography have found a huge audience of those wanting to better make sense of how it shapes the globe. The first was Prisoners of Geography, 10 maps that explain everything about our world, and Tim has since followed it up with titles including Divided, Why We're Living in an Age of Walls, Power of Geography, and the newly released The Future of Geography, How Power and Politics in Space Will Change Our World. Recently, Tim joined journalist and presenter Ridhula Shah for an Intelligence Squared live event, How Geography Explains Our World, at London's Conway Hall. It was a packed house, and Tim answered questions on topics ranging from the lay of the land on planet Earth to how we can map out outer space, and he also reflected on the crisis in Israel and Gaza, a location he spent years reporting from. There's a lot to fit in, so this one is coming to you in two halves. If you're an Intelligence Squared member, you can get the whole thing right now. No waiting around. Head to intelligencesquared.com/membership to sign up, and you'll get the extended version of this chat, plus all of our extra content, ad-free listening, and updates on our live events like the one you're about to hear too. Or hit subscribe on Apple for just the audio. Let's join Tim Marshall and our host Ridhula Shah now with more.
Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm delighted to introduce our guest tonight, Tim Marshall. Tim's had a career of two equally impressive parts. He's reported from 40 countries, including Croatia, Bosnia, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Israel. But more recently, his second career is as the author of books I've spotted on bookshelves and bars and coffee shops all over the world. Tell me the titles of your books, Tim.
Dirty Northern Bastards is the one I'm most proud of.
A history of Leeds United, perhaps?
It's a history of British football champs.
Yeah. Anyway, three really good books. The latest one is called The Future of Geography, How Power and Politics in Space Will Change Our World. So I hope, Tim, tonight we can actually draw on that great breadth of experience and knowledge that you bring to this conversation. The latest one about space, we'll get into that too, and some of the imminent, actually, challenges facing global relations. And a reminder to all of you, we're going to chat for about an hour or so. There will be plenty of time for your questions, so do keep a note of anything you'd like to ask Tim, both in the room and online. Down here in the room, there'll be roving mics. Up there, I think there are microphones on either side of the balcony. And if you're online, you can click the Q&A button and stick your question in under the video screen and press send, and we'll try to get to as many of them as we can. Right, so, Tim, not much going on in the world right now. A couple of wars, perhaps more than a couple, actually. The limits of US power being tested. extraordinary relationship developing between Russia and China, North Korea, unpredictable, just a few bits and bobs. So we can have this conversation, though, within the framework of your thinking, how do you think that we can think about any of these ongoing events, pick one of your choice, and really make this argument that geography matters?
Before I do that, thank you to Intelligence Squared, and thank you for giving up this beautiful, balmy, early spring evening. The best example, really, is Russia-Ukraine, of how geography is such an important part of what happens. I'm not a geographic determinist. You know, there are many elements to why stuff happens. But if you don't get geography, you're missing a big part of that picture. So there are perhaps asinine examples. When Henry VIII decided he wanted a navy, his courtiers could say, yes, sir, because we've got loads of trees. Yeah, if we'd happened to be in Somaliland, fewer trees. So there's an asinine example, but a modern one is the geography of Russia and then the history that played out on that geography, which brings us to the North European plain. Begins in France, sweeps across Northern Europe and into Russia. Its narrowest point was Poland. They've got the Baltic there, Carpathian Mountains there. So if you wanted to go to Russia, you're not going to swim there, you're not going to climb there. You're going to go through that gap, that 300-mile-wide gap. It then opens up to the flatland in front of Russia, in front particularly of its two centres of gravity, St. Petersburg and Moscow. So that's the physical geography of the place. And in front of those two cities is Belarus and Ukraine, mostly flat. So that's the geography of it. Now, the history of it is that in the Russian head, and this did happen, but in the Russian mind, and think of it from Russian terms, you're looking westward, and from that direction, through that gap, has come the Polish-Lithuanian troops that invaded Russia, has come the Swedish Empire, which invaded through that gap, Napoleon 1812, the Germans 1914, the Germans 1941. And those are just some of the examples. So think what that does to you. You're aware of the geography, you're aware of the gap, you're aware of the history that has happened. Consequently, you will seek to plug that gap, either by having Poland as an ally, which is complicated, or occupying it, which was the usual solution. Come all the way up to 1891, and the Poles, like every single other country, decided, you know what, we'd really like to have a different version of the future, and looked westward. So they've lost the gap. You fall back to the flat ground in front of you as a buffer zone, Belarus, Ukraine. And Belarus is nailed on, but when Ukraine flips and decides it wants a different future, at that point the alarm bells are going off left, right and centre, for a number of reasons, not least of which your only warm water port, which you have on lease from Ukraine, is down in Crimea. You've only got 30 years left on the lease. Now, there's a whole bunch of other things going on. There's the nationalism. There's the seeking to undermine the post-Second World War order, the rules-based system, which was manufactured by America. And China and Russia set out at the beginning of this century to undermine that, and they've done it quite successfully. So there's a whole bunch of other things, but that's the geographic underpinning of why Putin has acted the way he has. And he can sell this story very easily to the Russian public because they remember all those historic dates that I said. They're looking westwards and he's telling them, if we don't do this, the barbarians will be at the gates again.
And just to clarify a point that you made, you're not a geographic determinist because you do recognise that Putin is very aware of history, of law, of all kinds of other things, the rise of the West and the Western order and things.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and he wants the minerals that are in Ukraine. It's underreported. There's a lot of quite precious minerals. The land, the wheat, the ports, Odessa. There's the nationalism. If you read his essay from the summer before the invasion, He appears to believe all sorts of strange things like the superiority of the Slavic soul. It is superior to non-Slavic people's souls. And that as the Ukrainians are really Russian and Slavic, we must, you know, there's all that stuff. There's the Third Rome idea, which he buys after Rome, and the schism of the Catholic Church, and then Constantinople and the breakup. And then the Eastern Orthodox and the rest of it, well, the third true Rome, a true Christianity, is Moscow. So there's all that stuff. But the one that is, I believe, really a big part of it is the geography of it.
Holding that thought in mind then, let's think about the death of Alexei Navalny, a longtime figurehead of the Russian opposition. What do you think his death tells us about Putin and Russia under Putin?
That he's now confident that he's sewn it up, he's sewn everything up. I was arguing in a forum a few weeks ago before Navalny's death. There's two things to watch for in the March election when he gets re-elected president. It's the scale of the victory, which will be by their choice. You know, it's not how many votes, it's who counts the votes. But the other thing to look for is the scale of opposition on the streets. Now, I suspect there'll be very little. Because you might remember back in 2010, there were tens of, sometimes hundreds of thousands of people, because there was still the element of Russia that was prepared to stand up and say, no, I think it's been crushed. Now, you've seen the things about Navalny. It's just a few dozen people.
Putting flowers and being extraordinarily
arrested,
brave.
Yes. Extraordinarily brave. And so there is, that remains, but he's got away with it completely. And I suspect that after the election, we're not going to see tens of thousands on the street. So the point being, I think what it has told us is that he feels confident enough that he can kill the leader of the opposition, essentially, one way or another, either with Novichok or I'm just going to make sure you die over a period of time. We don't know which way it was. His mother saw the body today, so we might know more soon. He's got it sewn up. He got rid of
Boris Nemtsov.
Yes. Well, the list is long.
Yes,
and the amount
it
of people
is.
That fall out of windows in Russia is astonishing. They really should have health and safety. Have a look at it. It's called Putinitis.
Litvinenko, Politkovskaya. Yes, it is a really long and depressing list. So we've talked a little bit about why you think Putin may have invaded Ukraine. But were you surprised then by the strength of the Western response? We may not be
not
quite
as surprised
there now.
As he was.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll admit I was. Putin and Xi in China both believe quite strongly that the West is in terminal decline and is weak and has no spirit anymore. Aided by things like Macron saying in 2018, NATO is brain dead, which it wasn't, but it was on life support. And it's been jolted back into life, proper life, by this act. And I think it's because of the scale of it. Georgia... okay, it's Georgia.
Crimea, though?
Even Crimea, I think, because that was little green men in 80% Russian speaking. I'm not justifying it.
But it's interesting.
It's the context. So Crimea inserting themselves into Syria in the vacuum that was left by the Obama administration. The sanctions. I mean, they've got PhDs in getting around sanctions. They learnt it from the Iranians. So I think he just felt that now is the time. And my personal theory is that both the kerfuffle that there was over Taiwan after Nancy Pelosi went and Ukraine, they both followed the withdrawal. No, let me rephrase that. The running away from Afghanistan.
It was officially called a withdrawal.
No, it's a military term. When we beat a strategic withdrawal from Afghanistan, the way I explain it is that it's the same as when you're kids and fighting or whatever. If you're prodding someone in the chest and they're moving backwards and you think this is the moment, you keep... I personally don't. So I knew they would be tested. I knew. I didn't know exactly where, when, what. I just knew that both of these big powers are going to test the Americans because they think they're on the back foot. And Putin prodded them in the chest in Ukraine. And he got an almighty shock. Not only did the EU find a raison d'etre, but so did NATO. And I think he was shocked both at the ineptitude of his own forces and the brilliance of and bravery of the Ukrainian forces, and then the mostly Western. I don't particularly like the term Western. It still is a thing. But in the 21st century, it's more the advanced industrialized democracies, because then we have Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, and India in. But as you know, 2 years down the line,
it's faltering.
It's more than faltering. It's cracking.
That withdrawal this week from, I can never say it, Adivika.
Usual spelling, yeah.
It's a sign of the great fault lines that are emerging.
Every index is going in the wrong direction.
The lack of congressional support.
Last year, they, for symbolic reasons, lost several thousand troops holding onto a town, Bakhmut, which had little strategic value.
But symbolically,
it's a bit like Dunkirk. You know, what a fantastic victory that was for the British. It's how we think of it. You know, absolute disarray, retreat, thousands killed, but you know, Dunkirk. So they tried to hold it. They didn't. At least this time, they said we're not going to spend all the lives. And the reason for that is that the Russians hold a 4-1 advantage when it comes to how many lives they'll throw away. They hold a 5-1 advantage on missiles. Mm. And the difference is that at the beginning, they were World War II nonsense, but they've put their economy on a war footing, and they're churning out the missiles almost faster than they can fire them. Whereas Ukraine is every month, you know, they're almost running on empty, and then they get some more. And that's another one of the indicators. So manpower, missile power, GDP is four times Ukraine's. And then we've got this problem with the Congress, which for internal reasons. Then we've got, and this is the biggest part of the whole equation. Within about 5 days of not taking Kyiv, Putin looked at his watch and said, how long have we got till the American election?
Yeah.
Right, we've got to hang on till then. So they've been running to the US election clock for 2 years now and praying that Putin... they're easy to mix up, aren't they? that Trump wins, pulls the rug from underneath Zelensky, at which point the Italians say, well, you know, the French, the Germans... Portuguese, the Greeks, most countries say, what's the point? Leaving Britain, Poland, Czech Republic, and the three Baltic states, yes. And maybe Sweden. It's simply nowhere near enough. America has put in more than all the EU countries and Britain combined. So if the Americans pull it and the rest of them pull it, you are just throwing good money after bad. That's a bad phrase because I think it's a cause worth putting money into. At which point, sorry, this is coming to the end game of Ukraine, and this is based on Biden losing and Trump winning. Biden has this phrase, nothing about the Ukraine without Ukraine. It's a great phrase. It's rubbish. It's absolute nonsense. The Americans will force the deal at a time of their choosing if they so choose. And if they pull the rug, they will go and through themselves or interlocutors and say, you got to go to the table now.
But irrespective of who wins that election, isn't that time coming nearer?
Yes, but I think it is. The majority of Republican congressmen and women want to end or dramatically reduce. A significant amount of Democrats do. The American population, I think it's a small majority, want to pull the rug. You know, we've done enough. What's it got to do with us, Gov? And I don't think the argument about what it has got to do with them has been articulated properly. I think you're right either way, but it's about how long it would take. Because if it's Biden, and they get the $60 billion or however, and everyone keeps going. When they go to the table, they don't go on their knees. They go to be able to say, we want this, we want this, and we want this, as they try to exhaust the Russians. If they go in a position of weakness, what are they going to ask for? What will they get? So it's a case of when they do go to the table, what is the position on the battlefield? The only thing I think that will cause them to have a decent post-war is a security guarantee. We can offer them NATO membership. In fact, they're in the waiting room, but nobody ever really intended them to come in. It's a bit like Turkey in the EU. They spent 30 years in the waiting room. Nobody ever really intended them to come in. So they're not coming in, almost certainly. And if you put that on the table as part of the deal, Putin won't sign it. He cannot sign a peace deal that has them joining NATO, because that's his raison d'etre, he says, for the war. So you have to give them the security guarantee that we will come properly to their assistance. And then they have to, we give up this, we give up that. We're not going to ask you for reparations, but we have got a security guarantee that everybody will join us in the fight next time. And if you don't get it, in 5 to 10 years, he'll be back for the rest.
That's quite a chilling thought.
He means what he says. It's funny, so often we read stuff and think, right, I couldn't possibly mean that. Have you ever read Mein Kampf? It's all there. Everything is in that he did.
Is that famous 2008 NATO meeting where Putin more or less said, you're moving into my backyard.
Munich Security Conference, yes. 2007, 2008.
Yes, yeah. So, yeah, you're quite right.
He laid it out then, yeah.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Picking on one small part of what you were discussing, thinking about that Republican change of heart on Ukraine, it is fascinating. I remember talking to a Republican congressman about a year ago and saying, well, do you care about liberty? Do you care about democracy? Yes, yes, yes. Why do you not want to give money to Ukraine? Well, that's not our problem. Given that that is a kind of a point of view in a significant section of the American political class, what does that mean for American influence in the world, given what we're seeing happening in the Middle East, the new rising powers in the Middle East, the war between Israel and Gaza? Are we seeing the limits of American influence now really, really straining at their seams?
Straining, yes, but I mean diminished, but not. You know, they are still the preeminent power, both economically and militarily, by quite a distance. But yeah, because again, going back to 2000, just because it's a useful date we can fix, and it's not, you know, there wasn't a Putin and Xi didn't make a date on the 1st of January and discuss this, just in general terms. Setting out to undermine the rules-based order American post-Second War, which they've done, and then America hands them basically a vacuum into which they can go. Because after 9/11, what do the Americans do? Almost all of their bandwidth, economic, military, political, diplomatically, is aimed at Iraq and then, sorry, Afghanistan, and then Iraq. For 20 years, they have put nearly all their bandwidth into something that actually strategically isn't that important. Mm. Iraq and Afghanistan, they are not strategically important to the United States of America particularly, and yet everything went there. And in that 20 years, all this other stuff happened. So that has diminished their influence and power, and because the Russians have moved into Africa, and so the Chinese and elsewhere, and the Belt and Road was rolled out. So I don't think they can get back what they had. When it comes to explaining Ukraine, I don't think the case has been made that, all right, you say you're pivoting to Asia, to the Pacific, and with all that that would entail. But the case hasn't been made that if you give up on your democratic allies and friends that are in Europe, do you really think your allies in the Pacific are going to trust you? Because they really aren't. Perhaps we can move on to China, Taiwan later, but it's the same argument with Taiwan. They won't say whether they will or won't fight, the strategic ambiguity on that. In the event that it came to it, and I don't think it will, by the way, I don't think there will be an invasion of Taiwan this decade. I've been arguing that for 4 years.
Don't think Xi would want to seal up his legacy, as it were?
I think he'd love to, but let's come back to that, because I've lost my train of thought already in Ukraine.
Sorry.
But if they didn't fight for Taiwan, at that point, what is the point of being an American ally? The Philippines might as well switch to China. South Korea might as well say, your troops can go home. Japan might even go nuclear. There's all sorts of ramifications. And it's tied also to Ukraine, because if you give up and you allow this victory there, how emboldened is Xi to act the way they want throughout the South China Sea and the international sea lanes? Enormously. And to prod somewhere. And there's another one as well, which is big theory stuff, but yes, the Americans came to aid help us in 1917 when they weren't sure who was going to win. It took them 3 years. That's not a complaint. And then they came back again in 41. And then they came back in the Cold War. And partially, you could argue, a little bit in Ukraine. The reason every single time is that America does not want one massive dominant power in Europe. Because if there's one dominant power, Nazi Germany, which has reached the shores of the Atlantic and is now looking where to go next, it's pretty obvious. So the Americans come to Europe and help it at a time to make sure that no one major power, Russia, Soviet Union, Germany, can dominate it, because then it could be a rival to them. And that case is not made to the American people about what's in it for them.
In a modern context, though, if you look at the efforts of the Biden administration to try and broker some sort of deal in the Middle East, given where we are now in this conflict between Israel and Gaza, it doesn't appear to have gone well. Netanyahu doesn't want to listen, which is extraordinary. He doesn't feel the need to listen to an American president.
I'm back to the clock. Which reminds me, I remember when we were in Afghanistan, the big saying was, credited to the Taliban, you've got the watches, we've got the time. Mm. There's so much in that sentence. So it's really complicated and also sensitive. Hamas has always worked. We've moved on, yeah? We've moved.
Let's move on. We could keep talking on the other thing for the next 2 days.
Hamas has always priced in how many thousands of civilians it will get killed.
Yeah.
Whenever it does something in Israel, it knows, all right, we've managed to kill 20 Jews. We know there's going to be 2,000 civilians die, but it's worth it. They price it in every time because it happens every single time. They know it's going to happen. They do that knowing that that will happen. You cannot argue against that. In fact, I was once talking to a senior Hamas commander. I was in his car driving through Gaza and I kept looking up to see if there was a drone. But it was a very calm time. And he said to me, you just don't understand us because you're Western. We will sacrifice the youth of every generation for 100 years because we know that within that time we will win and all this sacrifice will be worth it. So they will sacrifice every generation. They believe it's worth it because they don't think the same way. So they factored it in. But I do believe that the leadership, even in Qatar, but certainly in Gaza itself, Sinwar, the military commander, is a very good example. Despite, it's a funny thing about Sinwar. He was in an Israeli hospital 15 years ago, and they cured his cancer and put him back together and shunted him back only for him to lead this massacre. But I don't think he's a very sophisticated character. So what he didn't factor in is that if they do to the level that they did on October 7th, it's not just 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 2,000, 8,000 dead. I don't think he realized that the scale of what happened, that the scale of what came back at them, and I'm not justifying one way or the other, I'm just explaining some of the rationales. If you're going to have the greatest slaughter of Jews since the Holocaust, do you really think... This is what I mean, he's not sophisticated enough to understand. Mm. So first of all, he thinks, oh, well, it'll all be over in a month. No, it won't.
So they've overplayed their hand.
Oh, enormously. Secondly, do you really think Hezbollah are going to burn all their 150,000 rockets for you? Mm. Because the safety net for Iran is 150,000 Hezbollah rockets, which they paid for, in Lebanon. I'm not saying Israel is about to attack Iran, but if it did, those 150,000 rockets would come into Israel. And these are guided missiles, some of them. They're proper missiles. So that's their safety net. They're not going to burn them for Hamas. So this complete lack of understanding of the wider dynamics. And then this brings me to time. So if you think it's going to be in a month and you're going to lose 1,000 of your men and 8,000 civilians, but you haven't factored in that this time the clock that begins to tick from the day of the first Israeli action, and you never know how long. Is it going to be 3 weeks before the Americans say, stop? 6 weeks? That's what it's usually somewhere between those two dates. No, that's a different clock. Don't you understand? We're not on that clock anymore. 4 months down the road, I think, and prove me wrong within 6 weeks, I think that we're now within about 6 weeks of it ending.
But what does ending even mean?
Well, all right. 6 weeks to the end of major combat operations. We can come back to the day after later. Which brings me to the... Sorry, it's a very long answer, but it's
I know,
very,
it's a bit complicated issue.
Yeah, it's a very... Out. Yeah, it brings me to the US resolution that is now being drafted at the UN. Up until now, the Americans have never said... put the word ceasefire in a resolution. They've had two resolutions go through, they vetoed some others, but the word ceasefire wasn't in it. Mm-hmm. This time, the week after Biden said, you've gone over the top, which, if you're on one side of this argument, that's weak language. If you're on the other side of the argument, the Israeli and American, that's actually quite tough, strong public language.
Especially from a president who has
It has weight. It's a signal. Yeah. And the putting the word ceasefire, this draft isn't in blue yet. When a resolution goes into blue, it's almost in its final iteration before it goes to a vote. So it's not in blue yet. So it's still being drafted. The American resolution uses the word ceasefire for the first time. That is a huge warning sign to the Americans. That's what it means. It does say ceasefire as soon as it's practical and all the hostages are released. So, there's still a lot of wiggle room there, but they've moved. And that, to me, is the signal that, last bit of this argument before we go to the day after, Rafah. Israel has destroyed 18 of the 26 Hamas brigades. There's about 1,500 in each brigade. So there's still 8,000, 9,000 fighters crammed into Rafah. Most of the leadership will be there. Most of the surviving hostages will be there. And they've got 2 weeks until Ramadan, March the 11th, the 10th, because the Israelis have said that's the deadline. The Americans have told them, can you please get your plan in order, how to get people out of the way? And we could talk about that, the topography of it's flat land, the scrub land, just there's Egypt border, there's Rafah at the end of it. go a kilometre down towards the sea and then up the road and you come to scrubland, you could get some people in there. There's some, they've got some lovely, had some lovely water parks in Gaza. There's a water park just up the road which has some high-end hotels and restaurants and things in it, which again could be used. Yeah, there's a way of doing it, and they'll screen all the men coming out. They have face recognition, they have dogs to sniff for traces of explosives. They have all sorts of, which means that most of the homeless guys are going to have to stay put. If this happens, in they go. And most of the buildings in Rafah are not bigger than five stories high, whereas in Gaza and Khan Yunis, you know,
lots of high rises.
Yeah, multiple tower blocks. Incredibly dangerous because there's a line of sight of snipers, means that you're going very slowly, and then when you get in, checking every single floor takes forever. So this will be quicker. So I think if they go in, I mean, they might not, if they go in a couple of weeks, it'll take 4, 5, 6 weeks. And at that point, major combat, they've taken every urban area. They killed at least half of the fighters. They've captured thousands. And at that point, the next phase begins.
Before we move on to the next stage, just to remind you, will be a chance for you to ask your questions, and there's lots we haven't covered, so I'm sure you've got lots of questions. Do, if you're online, feel free to send them. And also you should tweet, I didn't mention that, or put your thing on X, is that what it's called now? I find it really all confusing. Using the hashtag IQ2. So, the day after, defeating Hamas, taking out the leadership, they are some of the aims that are comprehensible.
They'll do that. Oh, sorry, carry on.
I was just going to say, who else will want to have a stake in this? How much should we look at Saudi Arabia, Qatar? How much are all these countries also going to want to?
I think most of us will agree you can't defeat an idea like that. So the idea of Hamas will survive. You can just call it something else, or it'll go underground. As long as the Israelis are there, they will be subject to numerous attacks, you know, suicide bombings, whatever. As long as they're there. So they want to get out. PA? I mean, nobody respects the PA. Not even Fatah. They are the PA. Abbas is 18 years, president without an election and old. The West Bank people don't like Fatah anymore. It's hard to see. And anyway,
but is there a potential leadership in the wings? Is there a younger generation? Something I genuinely know anything
really
about.
Well, there are one or two figures around, but they are so riven with different factions, not just Hamas, PA, and PLO.
And even if you could find these people, Israel's desire for security is going to make it really hard to convince a really traumatised public that they can live next to this erstwhile Palestinian state.
This is why I actually think there's three scenarios. One, everybody falls in love with each other and lives in peace and happiness forever after. Two, two-state solution, and they, you know, have a relationship, which is what is going to be tried, and I can go through iterations of it. And then there's the most likely scenario, I think, which is they go back, the Israelis, to managing the situation again. I was in Beirut in 2006 for the Hezbollah Israel war. And the Israelis bought themselves 10 years of peace, of quiet, up in the northern border. By the way, something like 60,000 of their population are still in hotels. I mean, I'm not comparing the scale of suffering, but the strain on the Israeli economy is another factor in getting this done. You know, all the vineyards and fields, and they're all empty.
But won't there be people in Israeli society who now believe that Netanyahu's strategy, which has been for the last 20 years, I'm keeping you safe, guys, that has failed?
This is the big thing this year, because the Israeli election will be held as soon as they can, as soon as this is finished, because, there's a whole, all these moving parts are moving here. Yeah. Okay, briefly on the Israelis. We will get an idea in the election of whether the peace camp can grow again, because it's been shrunk over the years. and people that would back a two-state solution with various conditions can come back to power. I doubt it, but it's possible. On the other side, the two-state solution will be led by the Saudis, probably, holding the carrot of normalization of relations with Israel, which makes economic sense brilliantly for both of them, and militarily as well, because vis-a-vis Iran, because this is the Iranian strategic nightmare, their biggest Arab foe and their biggest military foe, suddenly. So you have to get past the internal politics of the two countries as well as the external politics, which is why I think you'll go back to managing the situation. Sorry.
A complicated picture. There's lots more to ask about that. I am going to move on because I want to make sure we cover lots of ground. So if you've got questions on that, please do ask them. Just to think then, to go back to your original thesis, there is a real neatness to the idea that geography matters, it's a major force in international relations and so on. But given, say, something like climate change or technology, is there a danger in overstating the importance of geography?
No. It just changes which bits of geography are important. We no longer think the areas where the coal is are overwhelmingly important, but the areas where the oil was became very important. Mm. Now the areas where the lithium is become, so the lithium triangle in Latin America, people are focusing it on it like a laser. It wasn't very important before. There's a copper belt that runs down the whole of North and South America. If you do maps that have different metals in different colors, you can see starting in Alaska along the coast, going in about 10, several miles, the entire coastline all the way down to Argentina, copper. So they become more important. So it only changes what, you know, it's still geography. Bangladesh, if you're talking about climate change, Bangladesh, as you know, sort of looks like that. And that's all the land and then the rivers in between them. Each year, the sea comes up a bit higher, overflows the rivers, salinates the land, can't have any crops, people move. That's geography. And on technology, again, that simply changes the which bits are more important. The British couldn't have pulled off the Falkland Islands victory without Ascension Island. You know,
it's a staging post, effectively.
You need bits of concrete all over the world still. Okay, so the Americans can take off now from America and fly halfway around the world. But you're still looking at distance and climatic conditions. It's always a factor. I was in Afghanistan with the Northern Alliance trying to get down to Kabul after 9/11. And we thought we were going, and a sandstorm blew up. And for 3 days, we just sort of huddled in these mud huts that were melting. And the Americans couldn't see a thing. Not a thing. So geography, you know, it's always a factor. It's just that it changes as our technology changes.
Thanks for listening. This episode was produced by Hannah Kay and Connor Boyle and edited by Tom Hall. Don't forget, there's more of that discussion in a special extended edit waiting to dig into as an early access listen for Intelligence Squared members. Head over to intelligencesquared.com/membership to sign up and get it all in one go, or just hit subscribe on Apple. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over 2 decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? to find out what we can do for your organisation, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.